Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm Pam Stack, your host. Don't go away. I'll be right back. Joining me today. I hope you're enjoying your day. I'm very honored to have with me today William Shaw, who is calling in from the United Kingdom. He is the best-selling author of quite a few books, but particularly his more recent books feature two detectives who are very, very interesting. The stories are set against the cultural and political revolution back in the 60s. They have been signaled out by the New York Times as an elegy for an entire alienated generation. Quite a high praise, for sure. Prior to becoming a crime writer, William was also an award-winning music journalist. And he studied music from South Central LA and post-punk. So it's a very interesting man. I'm so honored to welcome William Shaw to Authors on the Air. William, thank you so much for being with me. How are you this fine day?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you very much, Pam. What a great introduction.
Oh, my pleasure. I don't have enough time to list all the accolades and honors and the things that you've done, but what I do notice is it seems to me that writing has always been in your blood. You seem to have been writing something all your life. Is that true?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, not always necessarily writing it very well. I hate to think what my college essays were like. But the moment I got out of college, I kind of walked out of college and was in London, and there was a magazine called Zigzag in the early 80s, which was sort of floundering along on a shoestring. But at the time, magazines were just exploding everywhere. Print costs had suddenly dropped. Color printing was suddenly really a lot more available. And I literally sort of walked in and say, hi, could I do some interviews for you? And it was like literally grabbed by the scruff of the neck. It's the opposite to now. People actually wanted journalists in those days. And so I just, got my feet under the table there and carried on ever since.
At the time, though, and I recall what you're talking about, because Zigzag, along with magazines like Rolling Stone and other music journals, were very, very, very popular. Music really defined the culture at the time. I don't know if it's the same now because we have so many different genres of music, but for sure, the 60s to the 80s were well defined by the type of music. Isn't that so?
Yeah, and I was really excited by the sort of writing that people were doing about music. I thought it was, at the time it seemed really thrilling. People seemed like they were let off the leash, and being a music critic was an exciting thing to be. I don't know whether it is now. I mean, I'm probably fairly old now, and not in the same, in touch with the same sort of culture. And I'm sure there is something going along those sort of things. But at the time, I just wanted to be one of those writers who got to go and meet these people and think pompous thoughts about their music. It seemed very exciting.
I hate to tell you that it's kind of like being a radio talk show host. I want to meet everybody I speak to. So I go to writer conferences and want to buddy up to all these people. I understand the feeling. I really do. However, the demise was probably not of music journalism, but just of print media in itself, wouldn't you say?
Oh, completely. I mean, I was, at the time, I was working for an American magazine called Details, in the 90s, and pretty much as the 90s ended, you could see everything beginning to get very squeaky, and everybody's, you know, suddenly the publishers came in with worried looks on their faces, and they stopped it being so much fun because they were suddenly thinking, oh, we're not going to make millions on this magazine. We'll probably lose our shirt. And suddenly that sort of sense of adventure was pulled away, and I think it became a lot harder. And I think the the more adventurous people probably went off into completely different media at the time. But it left a lot of people who had 10, 20 years run on this sort of wonderful sort of medium, sort of wondering what they did next, really. And a lot of my contemporaries were the same. It was a very tough time. Jobs that people, when I worked for Details, you could spend 6 months writing an article and be funded and have researchers around you to help you and things like that. It was a wonderful time. And the photo editors would have long meetings about the photographs that would accompany your articles and send the very best photographers to do this kind of stuff. And it was incredibly creative to be surrounded by people who are a lot cleverer than you. And I think that was, at the time, a lot of clever people went into that kind of print media. And they're probably doing other things now, but it was thrilling to be around so much talent and so much innovation.
It occurs to me when you're talking about sending the very best photographers to arrange the artwork for your articles, that probably now the bar's lowered and we're used to having cell phone snapshots, it seems. Yeah. I know that there are the paparazzi who have their big long lens cameras and everything, but it isn't the same. And I wonder, do you think digital media does nearly as well as print media did?
I it's hard to know whether we've landed yet. I mean, I know that, that the other opportunity is that, my daughter, she's 21. She is she's training to be a photographer. And on her course, they say, well, take your camera with you, take your phone with you anytime, because the phone shot might be as good as the one you take with that Canon you've got around your neck. And they're absolutely right. Sometimes there's, suddenly there's a lot more being thrown at us. And I think the problem for now is, how do you curate it? How do you get the quality? How do you work out what's really good?
Yeah.
Because the other thing is that when I was like 18, 19, 20, I barely knew what a good photograph was. If you look at young people today, their sense of their visual sense is so acute. You get young people who are like 14, 15 taking brilliant photographs. The trouble is, can they make a career out of them? Can they then take those photographs to make, to take, like I did? I was able to, go and do stories because, print media was exciting. If you showed any talent at all, you were said, go find it. I think one of the difficulties now is that you could be taking brilliant photographs, but nobody's going to be saying, here's a really good story to be doing in Florida or in Africa or something, because there's not the money to fund that bit. And I think that's the real loss at the moment. We haven't worked out how we do this next bit, because people love good stories, don't they?
I agree with you, and which leads me to writing novels. Had you made a conscious decision to forego any more journalism and begin to write novels because of the change in the market? Or were you always set on writing, I know you wrote nonfiction as well, but particularly fiction, had that always been what you wanted to do?
Always and completely. I'd always wanted, I took a very long circuitous route to get round to writing fiction, but it's what I'd always aimed to do. And even when I was writing nonfiction books, it was kind of like, well, I need to work out how publishing works before I can start pestering people with what I'm writing. And so I was always trying to go around that way. And I suppose the decline of print and having to, having time on my hands to think about what I was doing actually sort of reminded me why I was doing all this in the first place.
It kind of forced you to sit down and start typing out the opus, right? The magnum opus.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I had written a few magnum opuses, and I had very good agents because I was writing this nonfiction stuff. But, they hadn't succeeded in finding a home for any of my magnum opuses, because between you and me, they weren't very good. And I think, I suspect you've spoken to quite a few writers. You'll find that most of us, when you meet a writer who's written their first book and it's a work of genius, you get very jealous, because most of us don't come to it that way. Most of us have to write some pretty appalling stuff first before we work out what we're doing.
Sure. Well, those Cinderella stories don't happen often, that I know. and I read a lot of books, but not all of them are winning as you said. You know, you have to, you just have to work your way into it. How many nonfiction books have you written, William?
Five, I think. Yeah, I mean, my first one was a book about a phenomenon that was happening here in the 1980s called New Age Travelers. And basically, they were in the 1980s. It was quite hard to find homes. There weren't many jobs in the UK, and a lot of the sort of hippies and punks sort of fell off the back of society and started living in caravans and trucks and things like that, and found these little communities. And it was very idealistic to start with, but obviously, like most idealistic communities, you know, who they were trying to be Ken Kesey and his merry pranksters, you know, and right. Following them around. It was a great sort of story, but you know, it broke in the British news, and I said I can write a book about that in 6 months and have it out for next summer, which is when these people would live all year round, but in the summer when other people started using the countryside too, they suddenly became visible, and they, you know, all the sort of impromptu rock festivals these people used to have, it would suddenly get on everybody's nerves, so they turned into a news story, and so I said, well, I'll have a book out for next summer if you'll let me write the story. So I did that one, and that was how I cut my teeth on writing nonfiction books. And it was very much like that it was an oral history book. So it was very easy to write. And I love listening to people anyway. So it's just a lot of time sitting around with these people with a tape recorder on and then turning it into a book.
Did nonfiction come before your fiction?
Well, no, I mean, I was writing fiction simultaneously. I never stopped writing fiction, but my fiction wasn't very good. And, you know, I think it takes a long time for some people to find their voice. And, you know, I was there, you know,
I agree
studiously trying to be Raymond Carver or things like that, that I wasn't, you know.
Well, you do have to find your own voice. That's true. What feels authentic to you, you know, and sometimes it takes a while to get there. I'd like to talk about your Breen and Tozer series, because those books have brought so many accolades to you. I was reading some of the reviews from a lot of the professionals who really, really love this. The Guardian said it's a gripping story, impeccably researched. You were also called the best crime for 2013. It was an excellent debut. A question of why a killer kills is always central. William Shaw delivers a perfect motive in the third of his excellent Breen and Tozer mysteries. This is high praise indeed. You've gotten Crime Book of the Year from the Sunday Times. Kirkus gave you a thoroughly gripping thrillology, which I love that. It's a terrific, heady stuff, isn't it, to hear the professionals review like that. Congratulations.
Yeah, you should see the size of my head. But yeah, no, it's great, isn't it? I mean, because I think, you know, like everybody, you spend a long time trying to do this stuff. And then if other people like it, it's really, really wonderful. Even better when they buy it. But still, yes.
Absolutely.
That whole series just came out by accident, really, I suppose, in lots of ways. I've obviously always been interested in music culture. I work quite closely with a British historical thriller writer who's very well known over here called C.J. Sanson. Who doesn't do so well over there, but he's a brilliant writer. And we've been in the same writers group for like far too long. But I can remember thinking, well, if he does historical fiction, what should I do? Maybe I should try and do cultural fiction. You know, and I was thinking, what would that be? And I started writing this thing, and it turned into the first Breen and Tozer book. And partly I was obsessed with the 60s at the time because my son was probably, you know, 8, 9, 10. He became a real Beatles fan. And so I was listening to a lot of the stuff, and suddenly I was in that era, and suddenly it all came together. And I thought, why don't you write a book in which cultural events are the background rather than historical events? Now, obviously, cultural events are historical, and it's a bit of a thing. But, you know, the first book, you know, starts with a murder, and the murder turns out to have happened just behind Abbey Road Studios in 1968 when the Beatles were recording the White Album. And that just gives you an excuse to sort of drop into all the cultural stuff that's going on in London at the time, when London was pretty close to being the center of the universe. And so it's, you know, it's great to play around with that. But then, the great discovery was that crime was, for a while I was trying to write literary fiction, all those sort of things like that. When I started writing this book, I realized it was a crime book. And I thought, well, this is exciting because I know, if it's a crime book, I know how it works. And it suddenly set me free because crime books have to have an arc, don't they? You know, there's certain things have to happen in a crime novel.
Multiple times, actually. Right.
Exactly. And just knowing that allowed me the freedom to do everything else because I knew the arc of the book suddenly. And I can just remember this huge weight sort of lifting off me, feeling like after years of really not knowing what I was doing, I was suddenly able to know exactly what I was doing. And it was, you know, it kind of wrote itself after that. And it was a real thrill.
How delightful that you found that. You know, that had to be terrific. You have the fourth of the Brennan Tosha books coming out sometime this year, Sympathy for the Devil. And that is going to be an interesting one also because, you know, a lot of changes happening between Breen and his life and Helen Tozier's life. You know, these are a lot of interesting things happening in this book. I'd say you ratchet up the tension a little bit more, and you're changing your characters quite a bit with this book, aren't you?
Well, what happened is I found myself writing a person who's a bit like my dad as my main character, who's a guy called Cathal Breen, who's an Irish immigrant, like my father was. And if you're in the 1960s, I mean, do you remember that Bob Dylan documentary, Don't Look Now, or Don't Look Back? I always forget which one it is now. But it's set in Britain. It's him visiting Britain in 1965, 66, and suddenly you see this place, and it's almost like it's in the 30s. England was so set back by the war. It was so far behind America in so many other ways.
And
culturally it was way behind, except for these people like the Beatles, who were suddenly light years ahead. And there was this massive, I mean, I know there was a generation gap in America at the same time, but it just seemed gigantic here. And a whole lot of people who'd kind of got into trad jazz or something like that were suddenly facing this new thing that they didn't know. And I really enjoyed making a character who was the person the wrong side of that line, who didn't really understand pop music, probably thought it wasn't going to last very long. But he was a good man, you know, which most people didn't. Yeah,
sure.
I mean, even the Beatles themselves weren't convinced they'd have, you know, more than a few years out of it. So he's sitting in the past side of history. And I thought, well, if you have him, you have to have somebody who represents now. So I gave him a sort of young 21-year-old. Originally, she was a policewoman as his psychic, and she gets it. She is a lightning rod for everything, not only everything that's happening, but also everything's about to happen, because she's almost like a proto-feminist. And feminism didn't hit Britain until the 70s. You know, again, America was a bit ahead in this, but, you know,
So, William, I just have to interrupt here and say it still has a lot of places, so.
Yeah, good point.
And Britain has its very charming fine points by not always being caught up to America. I have to say, I love the country. I love going there multiple times, so. So there's a lot of charm with not being caught up to things, all things USA, for sure. I like this character an awful lot, and I like the combination because they seem to be the anti of each other. They're just totally opposite, but maybe it is like with every partnership. You can't have the same strengths. You've got to have different strengths in order to be effective. Do you think that's why it works?
I think so. I think the other thing is, both of them actually admire and actually love each other's honesty, and that's their only meeting point in a world that they see as, both of them, for very different reasons. I mean, she sees the older generation as being entirely hypocritical, but he's not a hypocrite. She's, you know, he sees corruption everywhere, and she's very determined and pure. And what he admires is what is about to happen. You know, that she represents a culture that is actually looking for a lot more hope than the one he came from. And so they're really drawn to each other.
Sure.
But they're completely opposite, and they argue all the time. You know, they have very little in common beyond that.
Well, and sometimes the youth is a little naive, so he's probably just saying, she's too new, she doesn't know any better, but I appreciate her anyway. So that's interesting. You also have a book that is sitting in my lap right now called The Birdwatcher. This really is something very different, although you keep your crime roots and you are obviously still in London, but this is a different story. This is not part of the Bruning and Tozier series. So why did you decide to step out and write a standalone?
I just wanted to try something different. I'd done three in the Bruning and Tozier, and I think it's quite a good idea,
right,
just to see if you do have other things in you. And so I wanted to write something contemporary, but I wanted to write something about a place, and that was really about,
yes,
place. And I like a lot of the Scandi sort of fiction, the Henning Mankell and things like that. And there seems to me that geography there, the flat land and the cold land or a lot of those things, really works for me. I really love that kind of thing where the landscape is a character in the book. So I was thinking, well, if I was going to choose a landscape as a character, where could I choose that's different? And I suddenly remembered about 50 miles down from the coast from where I live in Brighton, there's this place called Dungeness. And it's a strange place because the southeast is like really populated, you know. And then suddenly there's this bit which is it's a huge shingle bank that goes out into the English Channel. And on the end of it,
uh-huh,
they put a nuclear power station because they think, well, nobody wants to be here, so we can put a nuclear power station in. So it's got a sort of post-industrial bleakness to it. But a few people live there in cottages. So I thought, I'm going to set a crime novel there. And everything from that novel kind of came out of choosing the place. Because, you know, when I thought, well, what sort of people live here? And the people live there are people who want to get away. And my main character wants to do that. And also bird watchers, because it's a huge, great place for bird to watch bird migrations. And so I thought, okay, I'll make this person a bird watcher, which was interesting because I don't necessarily know huge amounts about it. But, you know, I love having to find things out. So I had to
How
hook
wonderful.
Up with a lot of bird watchers.
I like the twist in this book very much because I don't even know if we call him a hero, Police Sergeant William South, but he has a really big secret in his background, and you're not shy about giving it away. He's a murderer himself, and yet we don't know anything about that till later. I mean, we don't know the details until later on. But you've also teamed this detective up with a female detective, Alexandra Cupidi. I'm not sure how you pronounce that.
That's good.
Cupidi,
yeah.
Maybe. Okay. Who's newly recruited to the Kent Coast. Tell me, what is the dynamic, you think, between South and Alexandra?
I think, ultimately, again, you know, as you said, it's a murder book in reverse. You know he's a murderer. The book is letting the reader work out what the murder was rather than who did it. You know who did it, and now you have to work out why. Again, he's quite an honest man, but he's got a secret. And I always think that's sort of really interesting, is that how you keep secrets. But she's just good. You know, she's clever and good, but empathetic. And because of another murder, they have to work together. And he all the time thinks, oh, this is going to be it. This is going to be what blows the whole thing that I've kept secret all my life. And he's right, of course. She gradually gets closer and closer to understanding who this man is, and the moment she understands who he is, she's worked out how he was a killer, and that's the dynamic between them. He's sort of he really admires her, but he kind of knows that he's kind of doomed by her.
This is the end. Yeah, I love this book, by the way. I have to tell you, it's one of my favorite books that I've read this year, and so and apparently it is by others. Peter May, whom I had the pleasure of interviewing, said it's the most gripping book I've read in years. And you know, that's saying something, because Peter writes some pretty good stuff himself too. The Telegraph said it packs an emotional punch that hits all the harder because of the absence of histrionics. I love that. I love the fact that you've done such a brilliant character study. And, you know, you said basically he's an honest guy, but he's got this horrible secret. It's got to be like a cancer eating at him. You know, you're on tenterhooks wondering, when does it all fall apart? Like you were just saying, I think that's what emotionally gripped me in this story. And as far as the landscape is concerned, it almost becomes a character as well. Was that your intention?
Completely. And don't you want to be taken somewhere sometimes in a book? And I think, you know, if you're taken to an extraordinary place,
yes,
that's a real achievement, you know, and it's I love
yes.
books, You know, there was a book called, by Graham Swift called Waterland, set in Norfolk, and that was one of the things I was, which was booking from the 1980s, and it's one of the books I was trying to imitate. He suddenly takes you in, into this bit of England which is very flat, and he's, a lot of it's about the natural history of the land, and there's a murder happened in this. It's a literary fiction book, but I just loved that sense. I'd never been there at the time, and I had to go there once I'd read it. You know, it was like, it was one of those books that really, you, I just wanted to be in the place after having read it, and I loved that. And I, that's, you know, it's absolutely what I was trying to do.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, why read if you don't want to be taken someplace else or to a different scenario or meet new people and all? There is just such joy in I don't know, walking in character feet, I guess, you know, walking in the character's footsteps to see what they see. I agree with that. What's next on your list, William? What will you be writing about? Are you going back to Brennan Tozier? Will you consider writing another standalone? Because it seems to me this book, Birdwatcher, is strictly a standalone. I don't think, and I could be wrong, but how would you make a sequel or a secondary story from that? I suppose you could, but do you have an interest in doing another standalone?
I'd love to do another standalone. I think there's quite, you know, I mean, I now you said that, you see, I am writing a book that is not a sequel to The Birdwatcher, but comes out of it. And it's actually a book using the character of Alex Cupidy.
Yeah,
I wanted to write from a woman's character and see how that works for me, because I've written these men that are often surrounded by quite interesting women, but I've never written a central woman character, and that's what I've been doing, and I'm just hopefully handing it in on Monday.
How wonderful. Let me ask you, so speaking of that, I often find in some books one of my great dismays when I read a male and female character, regardless of who the writer is that they're tone of voice, their timbre, the nuance, everything, even their choice of words is often very similar, as though the writer can't step back and hear different voices and you know, because let's face it, like for example in Brennan Tozier, they're from totally different places. And so yes, you have a nuance in their voice. How do you find writing a male and female character without making them sound the same, like the same voice? Do you understand what I'm saying?
In other words, you and I are talking.
You're talking as William. Your voice is very distinct. You're going to say certain words, and I'm speaking as myself. That, to me, is so critical to come through in a book. How does one, as a writer, accomplish that?
I don't know how writers accomplish anything, to be honest. It's just, I think it's constant iteration, isn't it? I think you've got to be really aware of that goal. Now, that's a really important goal, actually, for me, because I love great dialogue in books. I really do.
Yeah.
And I think most dialogue in books, not most, a lot of dialogue really annoys me, because I kind of think, well, they wouldn't say it like that. You know, I get...
Exactly, yes.
And actually, speech is so idiosyncratic, and we don't speak often in complete sentences. We pause at funny places. We use words slightly out of order, and it's the bit where I try and make it as realist as possible. I love dialogue. I really do. I love people interrupting, their voices tumbling. I also don't mind, and a lot of people object to some of the stuff where sometimes as the reader you just think, hold on, who said that? Because you've got these sentences coming, you have to think a bit harder, because speech can be like that. It can just be coming at you. Yeah, I mean, it's something I do work quite hard at, I have to say. And I rewrite my dialogue a lot, probably the thing that gets rewritten most in my books. Hi, Pam, you there?
Hi, I'm sorry, William?
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, sorry. My phone dropped just for a second, so I'm sorry. I had to call back in. I'm going to repeat it simply because I didn't hear it. But do you ever read your dialogue out loud?
I do a lot. In fact, after my first book, I learned that I had to read everything out loud. I mean, it's a very it's a very soul destroying process to go to your first book reading in front of real people, and you start reading your own work, and you think, oh, I could have written that so much better if only I'd read it aloud first. And I don't know a writer who hasn't been through the same thing. I think you have to read everything out loud. It's another way of, you know, you get quite lazy reading your own work.
But it's a great way to edit, isn't it? And there, especially dialogue, you really get a sense of how different or how the same your characters sound to a reader, don't you think?
Absolutely, completely. And I think it really is important to do that kind of stuff with dialogue. Couldn't agree more. And you know, just to keep it, you know, the realism in dialogue is really, you know, you have to. And I think I spend a lot of time. I do write down stuff I overhear on the bus and stuff like that when people say phrases, just because I think. I think it's a great thing getting the dialogue right. It really is. And I think also, you know, this is maybe a little going a bit too far, but actually when you have to create the illusion of realism with dialogue, which is sometimes, you know, even sort of, you know, pretending, making it feel like this must have been said by making it slightly idiosyncratic. And it is like you pointed out gender. I think that's really important, you know, like thinking, well, yeah, he's going to interrupt far more. And she's not going to be able to complete as many sentences or something like that. You know, you just add that to a scene and it really works. It comes alive at that point.
Yeah, I guess maybe because I read so much and I enjoy reading so much, that is a real sticking point for me. If I'm reading from a male POV, reading the male voice, and it sounds like a woman is saying it, or there's no distinction at all, I'm reading dialogue, a page of dialogue, and I can't tell who's saying it, that troubles me. Because no two people speak exactly alike, regardless. They just don't. And my speech is very halting because I have so many questions in my mind all the time. So I'm forever stopping or trying to rephrase so I don't sound like an idiot. Other people don't do that. And so I recognize that in myself, and I think that's why I'm so aware of it. You know, when I'm reading, it just comes out to me. I want to kind of change subjects a little bit and talk a little bit more about you. You live in the UK, but apparently at some point you were here in the States because you wrote about South Central Los Angeles. Can you tell me about that experience?
Yeah, I was writing a lot about hip-hop in the 90s. And it wasn't even that I was the world's most massive hip hop fan, but as a storyteller, I became really fascinated with West Coast hip hop because it was storytelling. And so I spent a lot of time starting to interview these people, but I'd be interviewing them in a posh hotel. I mean, I can remember interviewing Tupac Shakur, and we were in the Beverly Hills Hilton, and just thinking, well, that's quite weird because that's not what you're talking about in your music, you know? So I thought, well, I can't interview you where you started off because now you're successful, but where should I go? So I thought I'd give myself a year and spend a whole go down to South Central Los Angeles and just meet the people who are trying to make it in hip hop so I could get their stories as they were trying to emerge and find out about the lives of them. Because obviously there was a lot of fascination, I think, with inner city African-American communities at the time through hip hop because the spotlight was on that. So being a sort of geeky middle-aged Englishman, I just sort of launched myself down there and hung around street corners saying, "What will somebody talk to me?" And of course they wouldn't because I looked like an idiot. It took me a long time to work out how to do it. And obviously one of the terrible tragedies of South Central at that time is people weren't talking to anybody. You know, people were quite afraid there. So it took me about 18 months in the time, you know, to actually find ways in and find people to talk to. And I found out some lovely people. And of course, once you're there, people did want, I mean, one of the great things is that you realize everybody wants a chance to tell their story. And one of the reasons why West Coast hip hop had happened is because nobody was listening to these people. The only way they'd listen to them is if they really amped up the stories and delivered them as rhymes. And that was the only way people could pay attention to them. So when I turned up, when they actually figured out what I was trying to do, I was, you know, I found it really reassuring that people just say, "No, sure, spend the day, hang around me, that's fine, because you're listening to my story, that's all I care about." And it was very welcoming. It was really, you know, it was a interesting book, but I could have been from Mars. I mean, my background is so different, you know, for coming from Europe as a middle-class white guy. It was, you know, I was listening to extraordinary and very tragic awful stories. You know, I didn't meet a young man there who hadn't witnessed or been part of some sort of catastrophe. It was a terrible time.
Sure. Sure. When you're not writing, what do you like to do?
Well, there's I play in a Cayley band. Does that have any, is that word work at all in the States? It probably doesn't. Ceilidh, which is like folk music band. But for dancing.
Really?
Yeah, which isn't very hip-hop
really?
At all, is it? I do, yeah. It's great.
No, but you have it in, but you have such a variety of interests. That's wonderful. so where do you perform?
Well, it's Cayley's a type of dancing with a caller. It's a bit like, I suppose, American barn dancing, but there's a whole lot of types of dance. And so we do regular gigs in Brighton. We do one a month in Brighton, or we're hired out. We do a lot of weddings and festivals and things like that. So most Friday, Saturdays, I'm playing in a band somewhere. People are suffering as I play. It's great fun.
What instrument do you play?
I play mandolin, and I play very, very, very bad fiddle.
It can't be that bad if you're still in the band. They haven't kicked you out yet, William.
Yeah, look, I think one of the great advantages of Cayley is they're dancing. They're mostly listening to the beat. You know, the notes can go hang. You know, it's like, as long as you keep playing to a particular rhythm, then you can get away with murder.
That's
and we're afraid we do.
What would we be surprised to learn about you?
Well, that's an interesting one. Surprised. I grew up in West Africa. That's a bit of a surprise, is it?
Wow. It is. Can you tell a little bit about that story, please?
Well, after Britain stopped being an empire and decolonized, there were still these links to a lot of the colonial countries. My dad was teaching English and running libraries and things like that in Nigeria and Ghana. And so I spent a lot of, you know, we moved to Ghana when I was just for my fourth birthday and stayed in Nigeria for years, really, going back and forth mostly. But I spent ages there. And it's, you know, one of the themes, I think, in some of the Breen and Tozer things is trying to remember that, you know, some of that post-colonial stuff, which is forgotten now because it's very inconvenient history. I mean, it's pretty inconvenient having colonies in history.
Sure.
It's not a thing that most Britons are very proud of these days. And so a lot of the history that came with that is brushed under the carpet. So I quite like sort of saying, well, this is interesting stuff. Like we left Nigeria because of the Biafran War. Now, nobody remembers the Biafran War now. But the time as a political issue, it was as big as Vietnam in Britain. It was, you know, there are huge demonstrations against about the Biafran War. But people have forgotten it, partly because I think American culture is stronger and there was, you know, Apocalypse Now and things like that, which keep Vietnam alive. Whereas the Biafran War is just an inconvenience because partly it's Britain's fault. We left this country in a mess when we pulled out, and the war was always going to happen.
I remember it was a famine going on in Biafra. Very well.
That's
I remember that very
one
well.
One side basically starved the other one out.
Remember that. As a matter of fact, I remember, and this is a horrible reference, but my brothers and I, when we wouldn't eat our dinner, my mother would say, "Think of the poor starving children in Biafra." It was stuck in my head and will always remain there. And trust me, that was a long, long, long time ago. So I am familiar with it, and I do remember, and it's horrible. You know, it continues. It continues, unfortunately. You know.
Yeah, and it was the
those
first
who have,
of those.
It
was the first of those big mass fundraising stuff was around Biafra. It was the first time, and then of course it's Bangladesh afterwards. But you know, Biafra really was that sort of point. But you know, people don't talk about it very much in Britain anymore. You know, because it's just like, oh, it's a bit embarrassing because partly we left this country with conflicts, we'd put the lid on these local conflicts. Now, of course, you've just pull out without doing very much. The conflicts rise up and it turned into this war that killed somewhere between 1 and 4 million people, you know.
Yeah. Well, listen, Britain's not the only one who closes a blind eye. Africa has suffered horribly at the hands of greater powers. So,
that's true.
You know,
that's true.
Maybe not smarter, though, but greater for sure. What is there a book that's your go-to book when you just need to recharge your batteries that you will read maybe once a year, maybe once every other year, but it's a go-to book for you?
Well, pretty much any Raymond Chandler. Just it's a comfort zone thing as well, because it's just, you know, such a pleasure, and I know them really well. And recently it's been going back to, there's a writer called Alan Warner who wrote a book called Sopranos. And I like going back to that because it's so cleverly written. Didn't do necessarily very well anywhere. Well, there's a musical now, actually, written in the back of it. But his dialogue, we're talking about dialogue. His dialogue is the one I steal. He writes such great dialogue. I'd steal it. But so I go back to The Sopranos by Alan Warner fairly regularly. And even, you know, if things are really, really grim, I'll go back to P.G. Woodhouse just for a laugh, you know. But that's when things are pretty depressive.
Sure.
You know?
Will you ever consider writing across genre, writing out of crime fiction, do you think?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, yes. But
what would you like
to
try?
Well, I would really like to try something. I mean, what I really liked about The Birdwatcher is it had a completeness. It set out various parameters and then it fulfilled them all. And I really liked the way it did that. In certainly crime series can't do that because they have to leave ends hanging and things like that. And I don't know what I want to write, but I want to write something with which sets a whole lot of parameters and then fulfills them all. And I quite like, you know, so it's not a subject area. It's more of a formal sort of thing. But I don't know what it's about, and I don't know quite when I'd do it, because at the moment I'm flat out on crime fiction.
Will you tell everyone where to find you on the web, please? Your website and then Facebook and everything else, please.
Yeah, I'm williamshaw.com, all one word. And on Facebook, I'm William Shaw Writer. And William One Shore on Twitter, and also on the same thing on Instagram. So that's one of the
numbers. And I will tell you that William does friend request, and he does answer. He was delightful. I have to tell you that when you go to his website, the first thing you see is a lovely gray and white paisley background with a woman with a pink bikini and pink sunglasses. So you're just going to be really surprised. You'll think, I'm in the wrong place. This is a romance author's website. But alas, it is not. It is William's. It's delightful. William Shaw, I am so happy and so honored that you came on my show. I've been delighted to talk to you. Just absolutely wonderful. Will you come back again one time soon?
If it's this much fun, I would. It's just been great, Pam. Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure. I've really enjoyed this a lot. I was looking forward to it. I had read the books a while ago because I have the galley. So it was just a lot of fun, and I'm glad we got to do this. I really am. Thank you so much. I want to remind everyone the next show I do will be on Friday at 3 o'clock with Thorn and Cross. They are the host of our horror show. They have a new book out called The Witches of Ravencrest. And then that evening, award-winning crime fiction author, I think she's won every crime fiction award there is, Margaret Maron, is going to be with me. In the meantime, have a great afternoon. William Shaw, thank you so much. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, everyone. Thank you, William.
Thank you. That was brilliant.